The following is a presentation of the Six Arrows Radio Network.
Before we start today's show, we have a very important announcement.
If you want to continue receiving your bi-weekly deep dive on technical and making topics of interest to you, the radio amateur, we need your support now more than ever.
Wait a minute, Jeremy. You sound like an NPR pledge drive. Are you going to hit up our listeners for money?
Not at all, George, but we do need their support.
Okay, well, what do you want them to do?
We need them to dig deep and open up their favorite podcast app, such as iTunes Podcast, Google Play Music, or Pocket Cast, and subscribe to the new Ham Radio Workbench feed.
If they do that, do they get a free tote bag?
Stick around to find out on this week's Ham Radio Workbench.
Welcome to the Workbench. I'm your host, George, KJ6VU.
And I'm Jeremy, KF7IJZ.
This episode of the Workbench is brought to you by Elecraft, makers of high-performance radios, amplifiers, and other great station accessories. Check them out at www.elecraft.com. And by Autodesk, the makers of Eagle PCB design tools, the software we use to design all of our Workbench build projects. For more info and your free copy of Eagle, go to www.autodesk.com/Eagle today.
Welcome to the Ham Radio Workbench podcast, your bi-weekly deep dive on technical and making topics of interest to the radio amateur. George, I've got bad news.
Uh-oh, what's that, Jeremy?
There are no tote bags.
Oh, man. Set expectations that they're going to get a tote bag.
Well, you asked a question. I gave an answer.
Yeah. Okay.
So let's talk about everything we have to talk about tonight. So, of course, first and foremost, here in a second, we will get into our move to the new feed and some other exciting things that we have been doing with the podcast. And on top of that, this is going to be very conversational tonight, but we're also going to be teasing a lot of the exciting things we have coming up in 2018. So, it's December 8th.
Yeah, I know. Time's really flown. You know what episode this is?
This is episode 39.
And I'd like to remind you that when we first started doing this, we had a plan to do how many episodes?
Like 5, 6 was a stretch.
Yeah, and we were trying to figure out how we could possibly go past 6 episodes.
I know.
I think we did a whole, like, first 6 episodes on selecting your favorite Phillips screwdriver.
We did indeed. And of course, actually, first and foremost, we would not still be here doing this if it weren't for you, our listeners. And as we round out the year, this will be our last episode of 2017. But I want to convey once again how appreciative we are for the folks who spend, you know, anywhere from 30 seconds to 3 hours with us every other week. So George, let's start off by expanding on the news of the new Ham Radio Workbench podcast.
The new news is that we have our own podcast feed, as you said in the beginning of the show. And what that means is that rather than get your Workbench podcast in the same feed as the regular Ham Radio 360 show, we will be in a different feed, which means you have to subscribe to that specifically. In the same way that when John launched his Field Radio podcast, he did that in his own feed as well.
That's right. And we are currently published through iTunes and through Google Play Music, and also have submitted to the Pocket Casts app for the folks who use that. Of course, we have a standard RSS feed, which is available on our new website, www.hamradioworkbench.com.
That's right. And on that website, you can get all of the episodes in the whole catalog back to episode number 1. So you can listen off the website or through your favorite podcast player.
Yeah, and there are ultimately a few reasons that that we are doing this. As George mentioned, this is following the same model that the Field Radio podcast has done. And one of the big motivators is there are folks who prefer one show over another, and this will simplify things for listeners who are interested in getting one of the three shows, be it the main Ham Radio 360 show, which will return in January, the Workbench, which is now the Ham Radio Workbench, or the Field Radio podcast.
So when we were looking at bringing on John's show, the third show, we could have stuffed that show in the same feed as the 360 show and the Workbench, but logistics are kind of complicated, and that means there's a lot of work for Kale to post all the shows and put all the notes on the webpage and so on. So at that time, we decided that John's show would be better off in its own feed and more manageable because of that. And then we were looking at our show, trying to figure out, well, do we continue doing it the way we've been doing it, or do we move it off to its own feed, which causes all of you wonderful listeners to have to actually go press that button to subscribe. And that's a really important thing to do, because if you guys don't do that, then eventually you're going to stop getting this show and we're going to lose you, our wonderful audience. And so, of course, we don't want that to happen.
Right now, we will continue posting in the Ham Radio 360 feed through the final show, or our final show, rather, in January, which I think if we did the math right, we figured out there will be three shows in January. So this is the first of four opportunities for the reminder to please take a moment, pause our podcast right now, go over and subscribe to the new feed, the Ham Radio Workbench. It is just Ham Radio Workbench in your podcast app of choice. Bookmark the website www.hamradioworkbench.com. Now, one of the things, to that point about the logistics and sharing the workload. So Kale may have taken an on-air break, but one of the things that we also, in addition to being appreciative of our listeners, we cannot express enough gratitude to all of the work that Kale has been giving us behind the scenes. He has been coaching us on how to get things set up. He has been continuing to post our episodes and doing some fantastic artwork and teaching us how to do that artwork, and he continuing to provide us all the support he always has. So he hasn't been completely getting a break, but because of him, we were able to launch this show back in July. It was July 5th of 2016. And because of him, we've been able to get all of these things set up and make this transition.
Yeah, he's been really busy, by the way. I don't know if you've all been following it, but in addition to the shopping show that he put out with Jeremy and myself and John, he was also on the Ham Radio 2.0 video podcast, and that was really fun to see him live and in person and talking about the show and what his plans are for 2018 when he comes back.
Yeah, that was episode 120. Which I know has not posted in Jason's audio feed if you subscribe to the podcast, but that episode is available on Twitter, not on Twitter, YouTube.
Yeah, that one.
Of course, as always, we'll make sure there's a link in the show notes. And what's cool is it is one of the rare opportunities that Kale hops on camera.
That's right. You don't see him too often. And he seemed really happy. I think this vacation thing is sitting well with him.
Now, a few of the other changes that we have that go along with this is, so we mentioned we have a new feed that you will need to subscribe to by searching for Ham Radio Workbench in your podcast app of choice. We have set up a new website at www.hamradioworkbench.com. In addition to this, we've launched a new Twitter account, which is at Ham Workbench. George and I will continue to post most of our content through our personal accounts. We have set things up so that there's the opportunity for duplication, that if we post something on our personal Twitter accounts, that we can have it duplicate at Ham Workbench. And then in theory, if I set this up correctly, then anytime a new episode drops, you will find out by following at Ham Workbench on Twitter. And on top of that, we are also going to have new email addresses. Since we have the new domain, www.hamradioworkbench.com, George is now reachable by sending email to george@hamradioworkbench.com. I am reachable by sending email to jeremy@hamradioworkbench.com. Or if you want to get in touch with both of us, and we encourage you to send us feedback, to send us show ideas, to introduce us to people that you would like us to bring on the show. Or if you have something you'd like to come and share with our audience, you know, a project you're working on or a new technology, or anything that is, that would fall into our, you know, category of topics, you can shoot an email to workbench@hamradioworkbench.com.
Also, our email addresses at hamradio360.com are still working, so you can certainly send email to those old addresses as well. So either one will work.
Yes. And so, again, just to recap, even though I've said this 15 times, but please take a moment, pause right now even, go into your podcast app, search for Ham Radio Workbench. If we are not in one of those things, you can go to www.hamradioworkbench.com. And if, again, we're not listed in the directory of your favorite app, if you add hamradioworkbench.com/RSS, you will get our feed.
So one thing I want to talk about real quick here, since we're talking about setting up the new website, we're talking about our own feed and all this, I don't want to send the impression that in any way that the Ham Radio 360 effort that we've put together with Kale and with John is going to dissipate or anything. So just let's just be clear about that. So we're going to continue producing our show as John does, as Kale will be with what he's doing new for 2018. And we're still going to be working together on a lot of cross-show content and helping each other behind the scenes and the website and the Facebook page and all that. So there's really no change there. So we just want to be very clear about the fact that this is, does not mean that because we're in our own feed that it in any way diminishes the collaboration that we've all had through Ham Radio 360.
Absolutely. And in fact, some of the exciting opportunities that we are having by also moving to our own website is, you know, I myself have not had a blog page in a long time. George, I know you have a personal site that you add stuff to occasionally, but we've had a lot of conversations off the air that there are things that we would actually like to do deep write-ups on, you know, projects that we're working on that may or may not have anything to do with ham radio. You know, for instance, when I did my Raspberry Pi cluster build, there's a lot of things I learned, especially, you know, getting through doing network booting. And we're also going to have the ability to create content pages on our website that are kind of like a blog.
And if we have other guests on the show, we can also post some of their content. We can have some dialogue with them there. We can point to their web pages, and it's just easier to manage.
Yes, it is. And it will give us an opportunity to bring more content to share with folks and to do more, you know, elaboration and deep dives on particular topics as we see a need for. You know, we've been formulating a few questions that we would love to get feedback from our listeners. And so one of the things is that in January, we will be soliciting requests from or soliciting responses from folks to a listener survey that we're going to put out.
So what kind of questions are we going to ask in the survey?
I mean, we are honestly, we're going to gauge feedback about things such as the length, the format of the show, you know, what areas of topics do folks enjoy, and also give them an opportunity to just give raw feedback on anything they'd like to.
So that'll be a great chance for people to give us their collective feedback and see how we can make the show even better.
Yes. So again, I very much want to thank all of our listeners for all the support they've given us. There's already, you know, Kale kind of let the cat out of the bag a little bit early, and we've already had some folks give us some positive feedback, and we appreciate those folks who have engaged early. Also, as a reminder, tell your friends about all of the Ham Radio 360 Network shows, us, Ham Radio 360, and the Field Radio Podcast. As I said, we're recording this on December 9th because as the, you know, there's this big holiday thing coming up at the end of the month. And speaking of that holiday, I want to remind listeners that PowerFilm Solar has an exclusive discount for Ham Radio 360 and Workbench and Field Radio Podcast listeners.
Yeah, it's a really good deal. We talked about the 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel giveaway, and Seth pulled the name out of the hat for the winner on that one. And he wanted to make it available as much as we could to all the listeners. And so they could do that with a 10% discount. And if you go to PowerFilm Solar, you can get the link to the Amazon page where you can buy that 30-watt PowerFilm solar panel at a 10% discount.
And that also includes an adapter cable from the connector they use, which is it's a Delphi WeatherPack connector. That's actually an automotive connector, but they have an adapter cable that goes from WeatherPack to the standard Anderson power poles. If you want to take advantage of this offer, or maybe you know another ham who's been in the market for a small solar panel, this 30-watt panel is perfect for folks who are doing portable QRP, running something like a KX2 or KX3, with a battery and a charge controller or other associated QRP rigs. You can go to www.powerfilmsolar.com/products/workbench, and you will get all the details on how to purchase this bundle and apply the 10% discount.
That is really like the perfect solar panel for soda. The thing folds up about 10, 11 inches wide, about 7-8 inches deep, and about an inch tall, and it's soft and flexible. So it really is perfect for stuffing in your day pack for a soda hike.
Yep, and I believe, if I remember correctly, it weighs just over a pound?
Yeah, it's about a pound and a half or so.
Okay.
And in full sun, the thing puts out about 1.7 amps.
Yeah, it's 30 watts. But anyway, don't forget to check that out. We really appreciate our friends at PowerFilm Solar for giving this opportunity. And of course, if you guys have been following me online for any amount of time, you know I love their products. I've done 2 field days exclusively with the large 120 watts PowerFilm solar panels. I've done a comparison video with some other popular commercial panels. And again, very much believe in their products.
And I think in 2018, we're going to hear a lot more from PowerFilm. They've really come on the market in the ham world in a big way. It's just such a good fit. And I think they're selling quite a few into this space, and would like to learn more about the technology, how exactly it works, as well as practical applications for it.
All right. So, you know, before we jump into what's on our workbenches, George, I have a question for you, because, you know, a lot of stuff has changed this year. I mean, if we go over things, you know, starting with the launch of, well, actually, even before that, we had another very successful Dayton this year.
Yes, boy, we did.
We made some very good, strong industry contacts. And again, I can't thank enough Joe from airspy.us for helping us out at Hamvention to have a truly first-class experience inside, sharing their booth with us. If you are interested in picking up what is my absolute favorite small form factor software-defined radio receiver dongle, please check out the AirSpy line of products. You can get them from airspy.us here in the United States, and you can get more information about the product line and the software in general from airspy.com.
You know, it's nice when you can buy a product from some people who really are good folks, and those guys really saved our bacon at Dayton. So it was a big, big favor they did for us, helping us out by giving us some booth space.
So Dayton was big for us this year. Of course, shortly thereafter, Ham Radio 360 launched its third show, the Field Radio Podcast. If you have not had a chance to check this out yet, also in that favorite podcast app, look for Field Radio Podcast. John Jacobs, W7DBO, on a biweekly basis. He launches on Thursday. His show is a bit more short format, usually run between like 30 to 60 minutes. And he brings some general information, does some interview stuff. He has a lot of content on his YouTube channel, giving really good visualization of some of the things that he talks about on his show. But the show literally does a fantastic job of focusing on amateur radio outside of the shack.
How does he do a show in less than an hour? We can't even get through like the introduction in less than an hour.
It's called discipline, George. He has discipline. I think that's what the D in DBO means. Discipline.
Teach us a few things at some point.
On top of that, of course, Kale was it October, decided to put the main 360 show on pause to take a break, to get back with life. And if you have been following him on Twitter, he's at Ham Radio 360. Man, he has gotten to do so much. In fact, actually, from the interview that he did with Jason on Ham Radio 2.0, I was a little bit jealous when he mentioned that he had actually been able to read like a lot of books.
14, as I recall.
Yeah, that was the number. So again, we'll have a link to that interview. A lot of good information, you know, addressing what's going to be coming in 2018 and some of the changes that he's going to be making to the core Ham Radio 360 show. And of course, none of us would be here without that show.
Yeah, that's right. Cale is awesome in being so generous with his time and effort and welcoming and encouraging. And if it weren't for him, we certainly wouldn't be here today. So that was really amazing. So I'm excited to see what he does in 18 because I have no idea. I mean, all I know is what I hear when he talked to Jason. And, you know, we really don't have a lot of inside skinny. It seems like he's got a bunch of ideas and we'll see what form that takes.
So, George, on top of some of those big highlights for the year, I mean, our number of listeners has increased. We've made it to episode 39 now, which, again, would have seemed crazy when we first started talking about this. That actually would have seemed crazy by the time we were at episode, like, 12. What else, if you look back on 2017, like, what is your favorite highlight of our experience doing the Workbench?
You know, aside from getting the chance to work with you, and I say that in all, really in all sincerity, I learned a ton. I think my very favorite thing is the guests that we've had on, because we've managed to have super smart, knowledgeable guests come on and talk about a very wide range of topics. And it's been really fun not only to meet many of those folks through this experience, but also to have several of them back multiple times and kind of become show regulars. So that, for me, really has been the highlight. It's kind of increasing the, you know, the host family, if you will, and the guest family to, you know, to more and more folks. That's just been really a treat.
Yeah, you know, and to that point, I want to specifically call out two individuals in particular that we consider part of the extended Ham Radio Workbench family, and that is Kenneth Finnegan, W6KWF, and Mark Smitty Halibut Smith, KR6ZY. You guys have been amazing cheerleaders. You have been amazing folks sharing your knowledge with folks or with our listeners. And we very much appreciate your contributions and look forward to continued collaboration next year. And yeah, for everybody who I'm not specifically calling out, all the guests that we've had on, we very much appreciate you as well. But I know even behind the scenes, Mark and Kenneth have really gone above and beyond. And I mean, for crying out loud, they bought me a BitX 40.
Boy, you're an easy touch.
Well, yeah. And then also actually throwing Nick in there, exploding lemur on Twitter. But again,
we're, yeah. And then you have to throw in Mike and Rod from Canada. And we need to throw in Nick and 3WG, and well, we can kind of go on and on.
Barrick, but yeah, K6BZ, Alan Wolke, W2AEW. I mean, there's so many folks, and we thank all of them.
Oh, and also one more is when we did our Amplifier show just recently with David, that was really fun. And we weren't planning to go for almost 3 hours, but we just kept going and going. And David was so much fun to talk to, and I learned so much that the time just blew by. And I think we're going to see a lot more of David on the show.
Yes. So if I look back at 2017, in addition to the fantastic guests we have, I think the thing that stands out to me, and This may not sound as altruistic as yours did, but I have a very good reason for bringing this up. So for those of you who have been longtime listeners, you're aware that in the very beginning, starting in episode 3, we started teasing this group build project that was the K6BEZ antenna analyzer. This was a custom PCB that George and Barrick designed. We had manufactured, and it basically was an Arduino-based direct digital synthesis module powered field portable SWR meter for antennas that you could source the parts and build yourself for around $50. And when we first started looking at this, you know, George, I talked to you, I said, I think we should do a run of 100 boards. We'll probably sell about 25 of them between when they went on sale in Dayton, and then we'll pray to God we get rid of the rest of them at Dayton.
That's right.
And when it was all said and done, we sold nearly 800 of them.
Yeah. Yeah, and it's unbelievable.
And the reason I bring this up is why this is so meaningful for me is, number one, it was a reflection that what we're doing with the workbench is on the right track. And, you know, George, we've talked before. Our mission is to prove that hams like to make more than just contacts.
Yeah, and certainly the building spirit is very alive and well in the ham community.
You know, we've had so many people reach out to us and say, you know what, I never thought I was interested in this. I built the antenna analyzer, and now I am just collecting ham radio kits left, right, and center. You know, because of the work that you had done showing me the ropes and using Eagle to design my first PCB, we had a few listeners come back and say, hey, I tried it too. You know, and knowing that we have the opportunity to reach folks and inspire them to try new things and really follow through on our thesis from our Dayton forum of there's never been a better time to be a ham. I am personally very humbled by having the opportunity to share these things with folks.
The emails that we get from our listeners are really important to us, and it's not because we necessarily want you to say, oh, we love the show, although of course we want you to say that. But the important thing is that when we do get feedback, we know that our listeners appreciate the content, and that's really the motivation for doing the show. So this is not really a moneymaker, as you might think, well, we have ads on the show from our great sponsors, but it's not a lot of money, and it's nothing to live on. So it just sort of helps pay the bills for the podcast. And the payment for us really is the feedback that we get from the listeners. And when we hear stories of people who have been motivated to go build stuff because of the show, that's really the payoff. So I completely agree with what you're saying.
Yeah, and I also like when folks reach out and say, hey, did you know about this? Or, hey, did you think about this? Or, I loved your show on this. By the way, here's three more things that you may not have known about that you could cover in the future. Again, it is all very humbling. I never realized that when I got my license in 2009, that the most enjoyable aspect of ham radio for me was going to be having a podcast on ham radio. All right, that's enough looking back at 2017 and getting a little bit sappy. But again, thank you, everybody, for your contributions, your support, and most importantly, for listening.
So, Jeremy, let's get into our workbenches right after this message. Elecraft is one of my top picks for high-performance HF radios. They make fantastic base station-style radios, amplifiers, pan adapters, and other station accessories. They're also the designers of the KX3 and KX2, the ultimate portable HF radios. If you're thinking about SOTA, portable operating, or travel, you really need to be looking at Elecraft. Elecraft has some of the best designs in the industry, compact, high-performance, feature-rich designs. You're really going to love them. The KX2 is my personal favorite for going portable. It's ultra-small, 80 through 10 meters, sideband CW and data modes, and the thing runs 10 watts on the internal batteries. You'll love it. Check it out at elecraft.com. So, Jeremy, why don't you tell us what's on your workbench this week?
George, for the first time in a long time, I actually have a ton on my workbench.
Okay. So, like what?
Well, okay. Let's start with some really amazing things that have happened here recently. So after about a month of waiting, one of the most exciting things to happen to me this year is Yusuf from AirSpy, the designer of the AirSpy hardware and the author of the SDR Sharp software and the Spy server. You guys have heard me talk about this pretty much ad infinitum at this point. But he was kind enough to send me a preview version of the AirSpy HF Plus SDR receiver. Quick reminder that this is their latest device. It basically does 0 through 30 megahertz on HF and then picks back up, I think it's 60 all the way up to 260 on VHF. This unit provides 768 kilohertz of bandwidth, and that's getting the alias tails in there, which is a lot less bandwidth than the other ones, which give you 6 megahertz or 10 megahertz. But this receiver is very sensitive on HF. There's a lot of automatic gain stuff going on. In fact, actually in SDR Sharp, there's not even a gain slider for it, which took some getting used to. So that's thing number one. And I'm starting to get the opportunity to play with it. As I get into the holidays more, I'll have a lot more opportunities to experiment with it. Because along with that, For those of you who heard the episode on frequency references with Dr. Frank, he put me in touch with his contacts at MFJ, and MFJ was kind enough to actually send me an MFJ 1886 HF receiving loop antenna.
Oh, nice. Can you describe that briefly?
Yeah, so it's basically approximately a 3-foot diameter aluminum tube. In the bottom of it, there is a Connex box inside of which there is a low noise, high gain, wideband amplifier. So this antenna is rated from, I think, 500 kilohertz to 30 megahertz. So that's the antenna. You go down the line, there's a little box, which is basically a bias tee. So what a bias tee does is it injects DC on the coax so that it can power the amplifier. You feed the bias tee. It has a fairly wide voltage range. It comes with a 12-volt power supply. You feed that in there. You flip a switch to determine whether or not the DC voltage gets sent up the line to the antenna or any other devices. Just like the AirSpies have bias tees built into them to run things like the SpyVerter or some of the other powered low noise amplifiers. And then you just run the coax to your radio receiver. So at this point, all I've really had the opportunity to do is unbox it and power it and quickly verify that it does receive stuff. I currently have it mounted on a tripod up in the spare bedroom where I have all the rest of my AirSpy equipment. But to really get a good feel for this loop and the new HF Plus, I'm going to basically mount this loop on a 16-foot painter's pole, which is a device that I own specifically for antennas and apparently hanging Christmas lights. I cut the hook off a coat hanger and duct taped it to it. It works really well. And then I actually, when I first moved into my house here, I took some PVC, I think it was 2.5 or 3 inches in diameter, PVC welded it to a PVC flange, actually mounted that on my deck in a corner where the railing meets so that I can extend the painter's pole, drop it in what is about 4 feet of PVC, and then bungee it to the corner post, and it allows it to basically be freestanding. The nice thing about this loop is probably very little wind loading, and I want to get it outside of the house away from any noise sources I have in here, put in some good runs of coax, and then see what I can get this thing to do.
So when I looked at a picture of this while you're talking, and it looks kind of like a ham radio loop, except that the ham loops have some way to tune it. There's a tuning capacitor to tune the antenna. So this thing is broadband. It looks like there's nothing to tune, right?
That is correct. There's nothing to tune other than flipping the switch on to send the DC voltage up. Now, of course, the reason this all came up is in a previous episode, I talked about the Wellbrook loop antenna, which is the same concept. There's a bias tee and a low noise amplifier at the loop. Same thing as the one available from DX Engineering that's, I think, was originally called the Pixel Loop. So same concept, wideband antenna, wideband preamp.
Yeah, I'm really curious to see how this works. The whole magnetic loop antenna thing is still a little bit of a mystery to me. And this one is a different kind of mystery because there's no tuning of it. I'm curious how well it works, considering the frequency range and how small this thing is. So, yeah, I'm very curious to see what you get with it.
Now, there's one other thing that Frank mentioned to me that is something I never in a million years would have thought of. And it's something that folks who had, over-the-air television antennas, in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, this is going to be obvious for them. But
what's
so,
that?
Well, okay, a loop is a highly directional antenna, right?
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one of the benefits of it is you can rotate the antenna to try to null out sources of noise if you need to. Well, what is super cool is he mentioned to me, he said, go to your favorite big box store, and there is a television antenna rotor made by RCA that's usually available for about $75. And you get the rotor, you can mount the antenna on the rotor plate or the mast that comes out of the rotor. And then you get a control box. Really, the only thing you have to do is get signal wire. And I think it's 4-conductor signal wire between the control box and the rotor. And then you can, there's a remote control even for the rotor, but it allows you to remotely rotate this antenna and you're not out a ton of money. I mean, $75 for this, when this whole setup is put together, I think is a very reasonable price to be able to aim a loop antenna.
Yeah, that's kind of interesting. Although when you say aim, it's a little different than a conventional antenna like a Yagi, I bet. Because with a Yagi, you think of like the gain lobe to the front of the antenna and some side rejection. And on a loop, it's like a dipole in that there's kind of like lobes broadside of the loop and nulls off the edge of the loop. So when you're rotating it, I guess you're really what you're really doing is moving the null around, the notch. And when you want to listen to a station, you don't point the notch at it.
Yes, correct.
So yeah, I mean, I guess it's in a way, it's kind of a technique to reduce noise as much as it is to point at the station you want.
Yes. And really, like you said, I mean, the difference between this and the Yagi is you're going to get the same amount of gain or nulling, you know, in 180 degrees. So front and back are the same. You know, it's not like a Yagi where you're aiming it like a laser.
Well, actually, on a Yagi, the main attenuation is not even 180 degrees the other way. That there's actually a minor lobe. Most of your attenuation is going to be off the sides.
Yes.
Or at some, you know, 30 degree angle or whatever, depending on this. Anyway, I'm curious to see how well it works. This is pretty cool.
Yeah. And actually, something else that I think is cool is this box is relatively intelligent. It can rotate in theory in 10 degree increments. And I think there's something you do to point the rotor towards north. And then, you know, it actually has presets for all the different degrees that you'd want to do it. But I'm curious to find out if I could, in theory, control this using an Arduino and maybe Bluetooth low energy. So I'm not fooling around with this, you know, with having to deal with this IR remote.
Oh, I'm sure there's a way to do that. I'm sure there's a weekend ahead of you to figure out how to make that happen.
Well,
but actually, that would be a really cool project to make a little board to interface into the guts of this thing remote it.
Well, and the thing that's actually kind of exciting about the project is, I mean, right now all you know is you have a touch keypad on the controller, you have an IR remote, but I mean, it's an opportunity to get out your favorite scope or analyzer and actually see what the control signals look like and duplicate them with a microcontroller.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there may even be an opportunity to ditch the box altogether and just run it from a microcontroller and some switching hardware. And the thing is, I'm talking about this, I'm super excited about hacking the rotor. But the long and short of it is two small kids, the holiday time, probably my curiosity exceeds my reach.
Well, set your sights low.
Yeah.
You won't be disappointed. Hey, yeah, you know what else you could do with this setup once you kind of figure this out? You could also get a transmitting loop and swap that in and get yourself on the air.
Yes, potentially. You know, and I mentioned in the episode with David, you know, we talk about, you know, the Alex Loop had a demo of a Bluetooth controlled tuner for, mm-hmm. you know, his loop antenna. I mean, that is an option. But I mean, right now I've really enjoyed listening. Again, for me, one of the biggest selling points, in addition to the quality of the receiver for AirSpy, is the spy server application. I have a tiny little box upstairs that these receivers are plugged into. There's a piece of server software and I can connect to that from anywhere on my home network. And I've even, just as a demo on the AirSpy mailing list, I opened it up to the public for a while so folks could tune in and, you know, basically get from 440 to 450 megahertz, you know, and that is so cool.
I want to do that too. When you're talking about the whole spy server software thing, a few episodes back, I made a mental note and I got the tiny USB.
Yeah. The AirSpy Mini.
AirSpy Mini. So I want to do exactly what you're talking about there. Unfortunately, that's project number like 29 in the top three, but I definitely want to get there. One other thought, by the way, for a transmitting loop, going back to the Field Radio podcast, the last show, Stuart was the guest, and Stuart is famous as the number one NAPOTA operator in 2016. So Stuart does a ton of park activations and general outdoor activating. And he made an interesting point, which is that if you're using loop antennas, they're very high Q and you have to tune them. But if you think about what's the perfect mode to operate with a loop antenna, and that would be a digital mode because it gives you the best signal to noise performance. So in other words, you can operate with a QRP radio with a digital mode like FT8 and have a reasonable expectation of actually talking to somebody. Well, the point is that where you operate those digital modes tends to be in a very narrow slice of the spectrum. So unlike CW or single sideband, where you might be tuning 150 kilohertz worth of 40 meters for sideband, well, for FT8, you can kind of park it on one frequency and you're really not going to move more than a couple kilohertz. So if that, so actually putting up a pre-tuned transmitting loop and not having to touch it, and running some of the digital modes could be a super practical way to get on HF with a very, very small footprint.
That's actually a really good idea.
Yeah, really, it sort of struck me when he said that, like, oh my gosh, that's a really good point. Because he was talking about, what John said, what antennas do you take to the field? And he kind of went through a list. And that was one of the big takeaways for me was like, oh, I never thought of that. So because loop antennas are not that efficient. And so screaming into the 5-watt QRP radio on sideband with a loop antenna is kind of painful unless the propagation is, really lucky. You're really fortunate. But under even kind of mediocre conditions, that might be perfectly adequate antenna with QRP and these new digital modes. So yeah, I would definitely give that a spin.
You know, there's one thing that's interesting is there, if you do research, and I'm going to pick on the Alex Loop just because I've had firsthand experience with it. And of course, you read a ton of anecdotal feedback of, I took your antenna with me while I was backpacking in the Himalayas and I worked 10,000 miles, on a quarter of a watt into this thing. There was an article from QST. I'm going to take a note to see if I can find it because I had seen it republished on the, actually like calculating the efficiency of this antenna. And of course, the higher the band, actually, for those of you who aren't familiar, there is a tuning capacitor box. There is a centralized aluminum support or maybe plastic. And then the loop itself is actually fashioned out of, I think like RG213 coax, which is kind of brilliant because it's flexible and it coils up and it allows you to collapse this entire loop into a pack that's maybe, I'm going to make this up and say like 6x10 or maybe 10x12. I mean, it's a very small little, padded case it comes in. Mm-hmm. But one of the findings of this was that, by the time you're done, this thing is rated from 40 meters to 10 meters, maximum, I think 20 watts PEP, if you're doing voice and 10, if you're doing CW. But this article claimed that at 40 meters, this antenna is only 17% efficient. So if you are getting the theoretical 10 watts into it, you're only getting 1.7 out. And this is where, to your point, these like very low signal to noise ratio modes, are going to have the best possible chance of performing, especially on those lower bands.
There's so many variables when you're talking about HF operating. So you've got the antenna, you've got the radio, you've got the propagation conditions, you have the probability of somebody being out there anyway to talk to, you have the operator skill. There's so many things that go into this that, some people will be lucky and some will be more skilled and some not. And, your mileage may vary depending on all those factors. But the loop is an intriguing antenna. I've got an Alex Loop myself. I've played with it from time to time. I generally find personally that you can make contacts with it, but it's pretty hard. CW, okay. Sideband, pretty hard. When you're running QRP, I mean, like 5 watts, it's a challenge. Not that it can't be done. Like you said, there's plenty of people who would say, well, I did perfectly fine with it. But it's not like shooting fish in a barrel, that's for sure.
No, not at all. But of course, the other thing that's nice about it is it can be made to be a self-supporting antenna. And
yes, and elevation makes no difference.
Yeah, or little difference.
Right.
I mean, as long as you're, you don't have to put it 30 feet in the air, you know, to be effective.
Right.
So, anyway, so I'm excited about getting to dive deeper in on. Like I said, I've hooked it all up. I've proven everything that has worked. You know, until I get an opportunity to get the antenna outside and kind of play around with nulling things out, I won't have a really good, opinion on how these things are working. I will say the AirSpy HF Plus is, number one, a ridiculously beautifully machined instrument. It is in a very, very heavyweight aluminum case that it's gorgeous. It feels good. The detail, I shouldn't be bragging about the case, but the detail of the polished, chamfering around the case edges, it's very nice. It has a port, specific for HF and a port specific for VHF. So you can leave two antennas attached to it. But it's just very exciting. I very much appreciate the opportunity, to use this and review it and talk about it. Yusuf at AirSpy has given us. So thank you very much for that. Thank you both MFJ and Dr. Frank for hooking me up with, the loop antenna. It's really exciting, especially for somebody who can't really put antennas out. You know, when I want to do this, if it works really good outside, it's like 30 seconds for me to get that painter's pole up in the air. So I've gone on and on. I have one more thing on the workbench that,
yeah, what's that?
You know, we sold, like I said, about 810 analyzers. And to this day, we still get people cropping up and saying, I'm interested in an antenna analyzer. And of course, for those of you who don't know, George, the main reason we stopped making the boards and the diodes available is because for this design, we rely on new old stock glass germanium diodes that have an incredibly low voltage drop that's used for the forward power detection and the return power detection. And these diodes basically became either very difficult to find in bulk or prohibitively expensive to find in bulk.
Yeah, that's the typical problem with new old stock stuff. And the funny thing was, the last batch of diodes we bought, I got a line on some diodes from a guy who knew a guy who had somebody in Eastern Europe, literally, who sold me 250 diodes. It's like doing a deal out in the alley. And it was really pretty funny. And I had no idea if I'd ever see diodes or my money back, certainly not my money back. But fortunately, he sent me the diodes. But it's hard to find them in bulk at this point.
So because of that, and because of the popularity of this analyzer, you know, we talked in a previous episode about looking at what version 2.0 might look like. A very brilliant gentleman that I have the pleasure of working with, who is a ham. He's the kind of ham that doesn't buy radios. He builds all of his own HF equipment from scratch. Has a very strong electrical engineering and RF background. And he has become a wonderful friend and a great resource. And as I was talking to him about some of our challenges, he made some suggestions of some things to try or some design considerations to look at when trying to basically come up with a way that we don't rely on these diodes made out of unobtainium. And so he's given me some parts, he's given me some ideas, and I'm hoping over the break I'm going to be able to get our base analyzer out, get this scope out, and start experimenting to see what we can do to get these back in availability sometime in 2018.
Yeah, that sounds like a worthy exercise, and maybe pinging Varick on that might be a good idea, just to get his thought on it. So one of the things we're thinking about doing is just adding an amplifier to the circuit, and that would let you use a different kind of more common silicon diode, but that would require a little bit larger board and a little bit of a redesign. So while Varick is still thinking that over, it'd be interesting to see what you come up with on the replacements.
Yeah, and I make no promises because, again, life happens, and I am certainly not an expert at this, but it's been an interesting thought problem. And you know, if I am able to make some meaningful progress, this would you know, solve some things and allow us to get these back in the hands of people who are looking for them. So that's, I mean, that's it. Oh, well, actually, no, I do have one more thing.
Perhaps a 3D printer build?
No, that's maybe during Christmas. At this point, I almost think that I'm going to take the box of parts. I will be returning to Midwest Rep Rap Festival in March. I'm actually really excited about it because I don't know if I mentioned previously, but my sister has actually started a side business 3D printing jewelry. And, you know, I made some recommendations for her in the beginning, and she's really gone whole hog into this whole thing. And so she got tickets as well, and we're going to be taking a brother-sister trip up there. But I swear at this point, I almost wonder if I'm going to be taking a box of parts and having the festival finish building my printer for me.
Well, and if that doesn't work, I have a suggestion for your YouTube channel.
Yeah. Well, I've already live streamed like 17 hours of me very slowly getting to step 45 out of 92.
No, I'm thinking you should just do a special like 2-minute episode of Will It Blend?
The pieces are too big. I would need like one of those industrial Hobart, you know, like bread mixers to do this. I mean, the trussle or the vertical sections, are about a meter long.
So, oh, okay.
Yeah. They're fairly tall device.
You might need a chipper instead of a blender.
Yeah. So the other thing on my workbench is not related to ham radio, but this is something that was really interesting to me. So a dear friend of mine, my Elmer from when I was in Virginia, had tried to put together a Windows PC 3 years ago, never got it working. It's been sitting in his closet. He's been doing a lot of cleanup and getting rid of old things. And, you know, I think I mentioned I have this year in 2017 have gotten back into Windows and a little bit of like build your own PC stuff I have not touched in literally over a decade. And he pinged me. He's like, hey, I have this thing. I have no idea what's wrong with it or whatnot. He's like, I'm going to ship it to you to see if you can get it running. So he sends me this computer. Like I said, it's about 3 years old. 3 years ago, this thing was like a top of the line gaming quality machine. The CPU was what they called a Haswell Extreme. It's an i5-4690K, which means it's overclockable. Had 16 gigs of RAM with big heat sinks on it that were designed to be overclocked. Had an overclocking gaming motherboard and some other cool stuff in the case and a nice power supply, yada, yada, yada. So, of course, I plug it in, doesn't power up. I start checking connections, doesn't power up. I do everything I can think of, and as I'm researching this particular motherboard to see if there's any issues with that. And this thing won't, literally, you turn it on, the screen doesn't even turn on. So you're not even getting through a power on self-test. And I read this thing that somebody says, you know, have you checked the socket for bent pins? So the last time I touched a CPU, the CPU was the thing that had pins on it. Mm-hmm. That's not the way it works now.
Yeah, right.
These sockets have a field, and in this for this fourth generation Intel i-series, have a field of 1150 tiny little bent spring pins in a socket that's about an inch and a half by an inch and a half.
What could go wrong with that?
Yeah, and the CPU itself is just it's the fiberglass with, you know, 1150 contact points in the bottom. So when I removed the CPU from the socket, and again, this thing has never been successfully booted. And at this point, I'm wondering, well, is the CPU damaged? Is the RAM damaged? Who knows? So I tear the thing apart. I pull the CPU out. And sure enough, I can tell with my naked eye that there's a section of pins that are damaged because they don't follow the same sheen as the rest of the field. So going back to our Christmas shopping episode, I pull out my handy dandy $35 pluggable USB microscope and I get down and I start inspecting. And sure enough, in this one corner, there are like six pins that have all been shifted to the point that they're making contact with neighbor pins, right?
Oh, wow.
So I watch a video on YouTube. I pull out my finest point tweezers. And these, I mean, like, you know, Nick had talked about having really fine point tweezers for working with surface mount stuff. Under the microscope, a single, you know, tweezers have two jaws, right? when you close them, they come together.
Mm-hmm.
One of the jaws of these fine point tweezers, and these things, you could cut yourself with them if you poked yourself, right? That one of the jaws of these tweezers was still four times wider than these pins under magnification. So I got all of them, all of the ones that were bent, and all told, I found like eight or nine of them that were bent. And what I suspect happened is maybe the first time somebody went to insert the CPU, a corner of the CPU fell into the field and would have caused this damage. As I'm inspecting around, I find one more bent pin off to the edge of the board that there's no way a human being could have done what was done to it. So these pins come up and kind of spring over so that, you know, when you force down on it, contact is made. This one pin on the edge of the board was bent backwards and curled in half. And it was the only one. None of the other pins around it were damaged. So what I suspect is there was probably a manufacturing defect with this board to begin with. I was able to get it straightened. I was able to get it bent back in the direction it should have been bent back. But I didn't have the spring to it that it needed to make contact. So as I did that, I broke this pin off. And there's, if you go look at my Twitter, at KF7IJZ, you will see pictures of this thing up close. It was a rush to work on. It was amazing to have that USB microscope, but in the end I lost.
Well, so you isolated it to a bad motherboard. So out of the whole computer, that's $130. You can just get a new motherboard.
Well, not really, because this is a Z97 chipset, which is 3 years old. They don't make these boards anymore. And so I did find a couple of new ones, and they were either $400 or $200. And because the CPU could have been, you know, electrically damaged with all these bent pins. It is a possibility. I didn't want to go sink the money into buying a motherboard. But you know what? Again, for another reason why I love this show, I put a call out on Twitter, and one of our listeners actually sent me a message, and he says, "Oh, I've got one of those boards I'm not using. Here, I'll send it to you." So, I don't want to reveal who it is because I didn't get his permission and whatnot. But you know who you are, and I can't tell you how grateful I am for your kindness and generosity. So he's sending me another very high-end gaming motherboard. It's a micro ATX board. And what it will do is it will allow me to verify that the CPU and memory are good. At that point, I just need to invest money in a new case and a new power supply and get the thing together. The reason I want it is I'm going through a process of converting my own personally owned DVD and Blu-ray collections for use internal on my network on a Plex server. And overclocking it will encode video much faster than anything else I have in the house. And then in his case is this really awesome hot swap hard drive cage. And of course I have a big RAID array for all my storage. And so it will basically become the home server that serves up media, encodes stuff, and could even run a Minecraft server.
All right. It's the Christmas Minecraft server. Will it be up in time for Christmas?
I don't know. I mean, honestly, because I don't know when I'll get that new board. And then just as we get closer to the holidays, of course, time runs out.
Yeah. Well, that's really nice of your benefactor.
Yes.
To send you a motherboard. That's awesome.
Yeah. So again, very appreciative of that. Can't wait to get it and try it. So I am making up for the fact that I haven't had anything in my workbench in weeks.
Well, it sounds like you have several things in your workbench. So very cool. Well, it sounds like you'll be busy over the holidays.
I hope to be. So George,
maybe during the break between Christmas and New Year's.
Yes, which I am taking a break, but the kids will be here. I know we're trying to arrange things, so I at least get, you know, at least 2 days in my time off to be able to dink around, which is my new favorite technical word.
Dinking.
Dinking. Yes.
Yes.
So, George, what's on your workbench?
Oh, wow. My workbench is sounding like your workbench. I just have a bunch of stuff. I think the stuff that's really bubbled up to the top is the build project board sets. There are a lot of boards that have been designed, and the prototypes have been off at the fab. So, wow. Let's start with the antenna relay board. So we've talked about that several times. I've got the final design done. I've got a stack of about 30, 40 boards that arrived a week ago. And I need to get a test board either to Michael or to Beric to have them put it on their VNA, just to sweep it and make sure it all looks good. We talked about this working fine at HF to 6 and probably, you know, adequate at 2. But anyway, that's looking really solid. I'm very happy with the design. The firmware is working fine, and I'm going to put together a bill of materials. I think where we're going to go with that, Jeremy, is that'll be the first new build project of 2018, and we'll probably do partial kits. And the reason for the partial kits is some of the stuff is easy to get. A lot of the common parts are easy to get, but there's a few oddballs like the coax connectors and the pre-programmed processor and stuff like that. So I think we'll do a partial kit with the circuit board, the coax connectors, the CPU, maybe the relays, and then leave the some of the jelly bean parts, you know, the discretes, the resistors, capacitors, and all that for people to scrounge up themselves. Or if we get very energetic, maybe we'll box up all that stuff too. So I think
let me ask you a quick question. So you talk about a pre-programmed processor. Did you do this based on an Atmel Arduino something, or is this a PIC?
It's a PIC.
Okay.
And the reason I use the PIC really is only a personal reason. It's just because I've done a lot more work with the PICs than the Atmels, and I could just get a running start on the project and get it done faster that way. There's nothing inherently better about the PIC than an Atmel AVR-based Arduino. You know, it was just easier for me to do the coding in the for the PIC. And by the way, I've used PICs a lot in very high RF environments. I've never had a problem with them. So I thought, well, let's just go with that.
Okay. I mean, that sounds reasonable. Because one of the other things that folks, you know, we talk about on our Arduino, it is a complete board with all the supporting electronics. But when it actually comes to the actual, in that case, that's an AVR32-8, right? Or 320. No, you guys made fun of me for calling it something once.
328 is fine.
Yeah. So that, but I mean, it's you know, that discrete chip itself is actually not that expensive compared to the cost of an actual, you know, Arduino branded board. Same thing in the case of the coax switch is the chip itself is not that expensive.
Yeah, that's a very good point, actually. So that's right. So the cost of the PIC that is on the current design is about $5. And you need a crystal and a couple of capacitors and a couple of resistors. And then that's the core processor. So for about $6 worth of stuff, that's the core processing element. If you're going to use an Arduino, now when we did the antenna analyzer, we used these sort of Chinese clone Arduino Pro micros. And those things were about that price. They were about $6, $7. If you went to SparkFund, that'd be about 20. So depending on the source, you could argue that the PIC is a third the price of the Arduino. It's effectively the same kind of functionality.
Okay. Now, you know, you talk about the crystal in particular. When I see these things, those tend to be surface mount components.
We're using all through hole for this board. I don't think there's a single surface mount part. The only surface mount part is there's an optional 3-volt regulator if you use the XB data radio, and that's an easy one to solder. But most people won't even be using that anyway. So the crystals that we're using are in an HC49 case, which is about a half an inch long and about an eighth of an inch wide, and there's two leads that come out through the bottom. So it's through-hole soldered. Now, the HC49 equivalent in a surface mount are super easy to solder because they're really big, and they've got little pins that stick out at each end. So those are very, very simple to solder. But for this board, we just did all through-hole.
Ah. So roughly, if somebody were to, you know, again, pretend they had the board and they were going to source all the parts, roughly what is the BOM cost for the non-XB version? To take a step back, one of the cool things about this board is you designed it to have an optional feature that you're either going to be able to do wired control or direct physical manipulation, right? There are some buttons on it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you have a row of optional headers and a little chalk outline, if you will, of an XB data radio that you could purchase and then be able to control it wirelessly.
That's right. So there's really several ways you can do it. So just to go over what you just said there with a little bit more detail. First of all, the core functionality of this thing is a single pole four position coaxial relay. So it's a board with five connectors, a common and four ports. And then there's four latching relays that provide the switch fabric to switch the common to one of those four ports. And that's all controlled by the PIC microprocessor. And the way you tell the PIC which one of those ports to turn on is one of those techniques you mentioned. So option one, there's spots for five little buttons that sits on the circuit board. So if you want to leave the circuit board raw on your bench, you can just press the button on the board and it'll switch to that particular channel, that port. Now, that's fine for debugging or for a benchtop test thing, but most people are not going to have the raw circuit board within arm's length. So the second way to control it is that all of those push buttons, the push button connections are brought to a set of extra solder pads. And for every one of the ports, four ports, there's four solder pads plus a ground solder pad. So you can make a little box and put four buttons on it. And the buttons are just momentary closures. You press a button, it closes to ground, and that will signal the processor to select that particular port. So you can make your own little control head for a couple of bucks. So those are the simple ways to control it. The fancier way to control it is through the serial port on the processor. And there are actually three different ways you can get to the UART, the serial port on the processor. The data radio, a jack that goes to a USB cable, and let's see, what other way? RS-485. So I that was one of the last minute additions to the design, is to put a 485 interface on it, which allows you to run a cabled connection with just a twisted pair over hundreds or thousands of feet. So you could put this board anywhere on your property and control it either over wires or wirelessly.
Well, I mean, and if you wanted to get creative because of the serial connection, I'm assuming you could technically, you know, there's not necessarily space on the board for it, but you could put a Raspberry Pi 0W in front of it. You could choose some other preferred wireless, device, like maybe something like an ESP32 or 8266. I mean, you have options because it's still, at the end of the day, serial control, right?
Oh, absolutely. In fact, let's take the Raspberry Pi 0W. Take that guy, and that has one UART on it. And the logic voltage signaling on the Raspberry Pi 0 is 3.3 volts. The voltage on the processor that I'm using happens to be 5 volts. However, the XB data radio is a 3-volt part, so there's a voltage shifter, a level shifter that's built into the circuit that'll take the three volt XB UART signals and convert it to 5 volts. And that's already built into the board. So there's a 3-volt UART and a 5-volt UART already on the board. So you can interface anything that's got a UART. You can interface an ESP, you can interface a Raspberry, a BeagleBone, you name it.
So out of curiosity, what are you using for the level shifter?
A pair of MOSFETs. So you can build a really simple level shifter with a MOSFET transistor and a pull-up resistor, and you have data in and data out on the UART. So you need two transistors and two resistors, and that's it.
And of course, for the control, depending on how you choose to interface with the board, if you put a Pi in there, you could write a very simple little web interface that the Pi serves up. If it's XB, you could build a dedicated hardware controller with a matching XB radio in it to sit locally on your desk.
Yeah, exactly. Another option for hooking up to a Raspberry Pi is, rather than go to the GPIO header where the UART is, a Raspberry Pi 3 has got four USB connections. You can get one of these FTDI cables that has the level shifter converter chip built into it. So you plug this cable into the UART port of the Raspberry Pi, and the other end of the cable is a 6-pin single inline packaged like header receptacle, and there's a 6-pin male socket that's on the board, and you just plug it in. And you just buy that cable from DigiKey, and you can go from any UART, whether it's on a Mac, a Linux machine, a Raspberry Pi, Windows machine, or whatever you got.
So yeah, I mean it's the core hardware is built really around the task of switching RF, and as you've mentioned before, you could use this to do one radio to four antennas, four radios to one antenna. You could, I think we talked about, you could actually take two of these and put them back to back and have a fairly complicated multiplexed setup.
Yeah, exactly. You can go four radios to four antennas, one combination at a time. By the way, one other thing that we're going to do is publish the protocol, the command protocol. So in order to tell the device which port, you have to send it a set of ASCII characters. And that is all published. So you'll be able to write your own little software to send the right codes to the board. So that'll be really easy to do.
Yeah, well, I mean, this sounds pretty incredible. You know, it sounds very well thought out. And of course, I know you're still making revisions. We're still waiting on the final word of, you know, is this good into VHF or not? I don't remember if I actually got this question out or not. Assuming somebody were sourcing everything else, like, do you have a rough estimate for the BOM cost for like just the bare board?
Well, so just the raw circuit board, it depends on how many boards we have made, but...
No, sorry, not the board itself, but all the components to populate it without the wireless options.
Okay, yeah. I would guess somewhere around $65 to $85.
Okay.
That's kind of a rough guess.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there are a lot of manual coax switches that... you know, cost $50 just for a switch that's a manual switch. What's the power capability of the board?
Well, I would rate it for 100 watts, but I'm sure it would handle more than that. So it should be fine for any 100 watt transceiver. I wouldn't run a kilowatt through it.
Of course not.
But it should be fine. So remember when we talked to David from Elecraft about the power amplifiers?
Washing machine relays, yeah, yes.
Exactly. And we didn't compare part numbers, but we're using essentially the same kind of relays that they use in switching in the KPA 500.
So if somebody's really creative, they can lower the BOM cost by visiting junkyards.
You probably can. Well, the relays, I mean, one of the reasons that we're... that we went with the relays we did. They're good quality sealed relays from a very reputable source, but they're we wanted to keep them down in price. So they're about $354, and you need four of them. So, you know, it starts to add up when you put in all the parts, but that's as opposed to using a real coaxial relay, which would be an impedance controlled high frequency relay. And there you're getting into, you know, $40, $50 and more for a decent relay. And you need four of them. So that's not practical. And at HF, you don't need that stuff.
So I think one of the things I forgot to ask is how do you power this board?
So it'll take an external 12 volts. One of the things that is important for any accessory in the shack is you need to be able to power it from a 13.8 volt power supply. So the power supply is built into the circuit board. We'll take anything from... probably 10 to 16 volts or more. So, you know, you just plug it into your typical power supply or battery.
But if you wanted to, say, put this in a weatherproof box and put it closer to your antenna field, I mean, is there an opportunity to do like a BIAS-T powering for it?
Sure. There's no reason why you can't. It doesn't take that much power.
Okay.
So, yeah, you can certainly do that. There's no BIAS-T built into it, but that'd be easy to add.
Well, the only reason I'm asking is because with this MFJ 1886, the BIAS-T that they provide with it is actually available on its own.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, you could just use that.
Yeah. I mean, of course, the board has to be built to accept power from coax.
Well, so the BIAS-T essentially is going to be a gadget that has like a coax connector in and out, and then a DC power connector where the power is going to come out. And you just need to make a little pigtail to then... have that go into the 2.1 millimeter barrel connector or two screw terminals, both of which are on the board. So, yeah, so it's easy to hook it up.
That's the inverse of what I'm talking about. What I'm calling the BIAS-T is the thing that would take
where you insert 12
volts in and then it sends it up the line versus something that receives the power and, you know, pulls it off.
Yeah, right. Where you're going to inject the power.
So, okay. So maybe not BIST powered, but so largely designed to stay closer to the radio than the antennas.
Not particularly, because we're not talking about a lot of current. So if you can provide 12 volts at the location where you want to put this, then you're good to go. And you could do that, well, over the coax. You could do that just with a twisted pair, because we're talking about minimal current. Or, you know, remote battery
and solar. Yep.
Sure. That would work fine.
And then, I guess lastly, I've seen pictures of the board. It's fairly large, compared to projects we've done in the past. Anyway, is this designed around a common enclosure that's available?
No, it's not. So we figured that there's no one single enclosure that would work for everybody. So the way the board was laid out, you can put BNC right angle connectors soldered to the board. And if you want to use BNCs, then you're good to go. If you want to put SO239s on it, there's really no way to PC board mount an SO239 unless they're poking straight up, which is just kind of a weird way to do it. So the way you would do that is you would mount this board in a chassis box, and then on the rear panel, you would punch holes for the or drill holes for the SO239s, and then just run little bus wire from the circuit board to the connector, which is fine at HF, of course. So that really meant you could put this in any kind of enclosure that you want.
Or you could go ahead and install the BNC connectors and then get jumpers, you know, 6-inch jumpers to go from the BNC to the SO239s.
Yes, or just put adapters on them, you know, whatever is convenient. This thing uses latching relays. So when it's powered, the only thing that's really being powered is the microprocessor, which is going to draw less than 100 milliamps. So, you know, when the thing is running, it draws almost nothing. The only time it draws any more current is when the relays are switching, and that takes like 100 milliseconds. So the thing is super low power. So you really could run it off of a SLA battery and maybe a small solar panel and just forget it.
You know, not related to this at all, but you know what you just reminded me of?
What's that?
And it was the very first thing when I went to go create the script that we create for every episode, where we have our notes and reminders to add links to things. The very first thing I put in it was a link to a podcast I caught last week that was fascinating.
What's that?
So we've talked a lot about the Amp Hour podcast. Another electronics and microcontroller, and practical application of these things focused podcast is called Embedded.fm. So it's about embedded systems.
Yes.
They had an episode a couple weeks ago that was all about microcontroller interrupts.
Mm.
And it really got into what is an interrupt, what are good practices for using interrupts, what does it do to the microcontroller, what are really into the meat and potatoes of it. It was very easy to understand. And if you have no idea what I'm talking about, just very briefly, a microcontroller runs a program in a loop, but that loop has to have a way to interact with things outside. There's this thing called an interrupt, where an event can occur that the microcontroller, you know, knows to stop doing what it was doing and pay attention somewhere else. The thing that I liked about this, it's like your computer. It's not like there's a program running, pulling the keyboard every single clock cycle saying, did you push a button? Did you push a button? Did you push a button? Right? Every time you press a key on your keyboard, there's an interrupt event happening and your computer is processing it. It was a fascinating overview that was very easy to digest. It made me feel a lot smarter about understanding what's happening in a microcontroller and some computing in general. So I have a link to that in the show notes. It was episode 224. So again, another podcast that's fantastic, the Embedded.fm podcast.
I'll have to check that out. I listened to one of the episodes, only one so far, and it was very good. So I would love to go back and listen to that.
Yes.
When we did the repeater controller, by the way, we had to use interrupts quite a bit, because we had so many things going on at the same time. It was the only way to make that work. We couldn't use just a polling loop. But I would say 90% plus of the Arduino examples I've ever seen don't use interrupts. Mostly they just use simple polling loops where things just happen one after another and then do it again. And for a lot of applications, like for instance, the relay control firmware in this board is just a polling loop. It doesn't use interrupts because the there's only one thing it really does. You know what? Actually, I'm mistaken. Come to think of it, the UART actually uses an interrupt.
Yes.
So scratch that. So the actual core code runs in a loop. So basically the core code says, is there anything coming in from the buttons? If not, you know, do something and then check again. But if anything comes in the UART, then it runs over, grabs that off the buffer, processes it, and then continues. So, yeah.
So, I mean, what's interesting, if you look at my MIDI mute button, which in theory, if I were smart enough to actually write machine code for the Atmel processor that's running this thing, the press of the button is an interrupt event. But to your point about it being a polling loop, the main program is a loop, and all the main program is doing is it is checking to see if a variable has been tripped from low to high or high to low. And the only reason it's figuring that out is because rather than constructing an interrupt that says on button press, you know, get the attention, then go run this code, then return to loop, the amount of time, even though I'm pushing the button really quickly, this clock is running at 16 megahertz. And so, you know, the switch may only be closed for 10 milliseconds in real time, but that's still enough that in a polling loop, it is going to see, oh, you went low, or oh, you went high.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. So the human interaction is really slow. So in fact, there's kind of a measurement of noticeable difference, which is how much time can elapse before a human really notices anything has happened? And we actually had to kind of figure this out when we built the repeater controller, because in the controller, we sample the carrier input logic state. So in other words, when a signal comes into the repeater, there's a logic state that says, hey, there's a carrier present. And there's another one that says if the PL tone is decoded or not. Well, so when that thing happens, we then have to turn on a transmitter. And when we run the controller, we actually read the status of the COR signals over and over and over and over again. And
COR is what?
Oh, COR is old-fashioned term. COR means carrier operated relay.
Yes.
So it's kind of a old-fashioned term for detecting when there's a carrier present. You might hear COS, carrier operated switch. It's a little bit more modern term, I guess, but I'm old that way. So anyway, when the carrier is detected, we have to check fast enough so that if we miss it, that the worst case amount of time is not perceptible by the human. And it turns out that we actually check for COR presence about every 5 milliseconds. And if you delay that any more than about 30 milliseconds, then you can start to detect a delay. So kind of safety tip, as long as your loop is running so that everything happens in less than, let's say, 10 or 15 milliseconds, then you'll never notice the delay as a human.
And what's interesting about this is, you know, we've talked in the past that Arduino is an not extracted. What's the word I'm looking for?
There's sort of an abstraction.
Abstraction. No, that was the word I was looking for. So Arduino, the language, which is roughly C-based, is an abstracted language. The compiling that happens takes all of the Arduino base syntax and constructs, converts it to the machine code that the processor needs. And, you know, one of the things we've talked about before is that some of the Arduino stuff is really time inefficient compared to if you could write machine code to blink an LED. There was a video that somebody had done comparing that, oh, if I write it directly, this is happening almost instantly. If I'm relying on Arduino, there is like a 50 nanosecond delay because there are 22 commands being run to basically set something low. You know, and that's the cost of abstraction to make it easy to program for. Mm-hmm. But it's imperceptible to somebody who's just trying to get this thing to work until you, it's not. But anyway, fascinating stuff. Sorry to take us down that rabbit hole.
Yeah, no, but it's a fundamental rabbit hole. I mean, that you know, using these processors to build ham radio projects is gone from the fringe to the core of how you do anything. I mean, you can't buy a piece of electronics today that isn't run by a processor. So, you know, it's kind of good to understand how this stuff works.
Well, I'm not going to take you off too much more, but just one more thing I was surprised to find out about. In the past, we talked at a very brief high level about what a real-time operating system was. Mm-hmm. Did you see that Amazon has released Amazon Free RTOS?
No, I did not.
I don't know anything more about it. I'll put a link to it. But basically, if you go to the page, it's Amazon Free RTOS IoT operating system for microcontrollers. Get started for free.
Hmm. Interesting. Looks like it's running on AWS. Yes. I never even heard about this. Yeah, interesting. I'd be curious to take a look. Yeah, so there's sort of an interesting evolution in the technology. A lot of the microcontrollers that we talk about using, like the original AVR Atmel processors and the PIC processor that's in this antenna relay, are 8-bit processors, and those are easy-ish to program. And over the years, the market has moved to 32-bit processors that can be as easy to program, but of course are faster and provide more functionality. And to support something like a real-time operating system, you really can't do it in an 8-bit processor. It's really hard. I mean, there are ports of RTOSs for 8-bit processors, but that's fairly unusual. But 32-bit processors, you can do it. And the reason is that the amount of memory that's available in a 32-bit processor is typically way bigger than the amount of memory that's in an 8-bit. So you have a chance to actually have an OS with all the code that's necessary to make it work. So I'm wondering what they're targeting. My guess is probably ARM processors, which are all 32-bit or 64.
So I'll bring us back to the antenna relay, because again, we just went super deep.
Yeah. What about that relay?
But actually, it's one of the things I love about this hobby, though. There's so much to learn and do. So, okay, you're continuing to work on boards. We're pretty close and pretty sure we're about where we're going to be on the final bill of materials. It's really more you're playing with placement and stuff at this point. So overall, our goal is to make this available, and it will be somewhere between raw board plus some core fundamental parts, all the way, possibly, we are exploring the opportunity of maybe doing full kits.
Yeah, and I'm thinking that the basic version of this thing is probably like the $50, $60 version, and the everything is like the $80, $90 version or something like that. So in that range somewhere. So
yeah. And to just be transparent with people, you know, part of the reason that, like when we did the analyzers, we, in the very beginning, we were like, well, let's offer a kit, especially considering that, if anybody has bought these parts before, you are well aware that if you buy in a large quantity, you get significant discounts, et cetera. But the long and short of it is that we have to balance the offering of convenience and price versus the amount of after the fact customer service that we would be able to offer, from anything from, oh, my, the PIC that you sent me doesn't do anything, you know, it got fried or whatnot, to, oh, you shorted me a screw in the kit. And so, you know, just to let folks know, like, these are some of the things that we're balancing when we look at what our options are going to be.
Yeah, and the overhead of doing this stuff, I mean, at the end of the day, we're not making any money on this stuff. The cost that we would charge that's a bit over the actual raw parts cost gets chewed up with things like shipping, because we got to ship the parts to us to begin with before we can ship them to you. And let's say programming the microprocessor. Well, if we're going to do, let's say, 50 or 100 program processors, somebody has to sit down at a computer and program every processor. And in order for me to get, you know, some starving student to do that, I have to pay them something. I'm going to do it for fun. So, you know, there's some cost to like getting this all together. But anyway, we're going to try to keep it as cheap as we can make it.
Yep. So any other projects for 2018 that we feel comfortable talking about now that we're exploring?
Yeah, well, there's two more that we should touch on. We talked about the low voltage disconnect power monitor, and I want to get that off the bench as well. That design, we have the redesign for that. I really need the time to make one and test it. So I'm thinking the antenna relay would probably be available in January. The low voltage disconnect maybe sometime after that, like February, March. But that design's pretty done. The third one is really kind of a big project. And I'm pretty excited about this because it brings together several small project ideas that I've been playing with for some time into one set of boards. And it's pretty slick. I posted pictures of this on the Facebook page. And what I'm talking about is what I've referred to before as the all-star node, but building an all-star node out of this board set is just one application of it. So let me take a step back for a second. There's a lot of projects that I've wanted to do over the years, and I always thought, well, it seems to me like there should be kind of a universal set of boards that you can use by themselves or in combination to build a variety of things. Things like a simple repeater, or a voice over IP node like an all-star node, or a some other kind of hotspot, or a DTMF controller for some remote control gadget. So those kind of projects could be built out of a fairly common set of boards. And so what I came up with was a set of three circuit boards that are all the same form factor. In other words, they're all the same mechanical size. They're 6.5 inches wide and about 6 inches deep. By the way, it's exactly the same form factor as the antenna relay. So there's four boards in this set. So here's the idea. Of the three boards, one board is a Raspberry Pi host adapter. In other words, it's a board that has a power supply and a place to mount a Raspberry Pi 3 and enough space to put a audio sound card USB dongle and solder the little jumper wires to the dongle to hook up the audio codec and some other supporting electronics. That's one board.
Now, out of curiosity, are you interfacing with the GPIO pins?
Yes.
And are you doing the work to actually register it as a hat on the Pi?
No, there's nothing on the board that tells the processor that it's there.
Okay.
So, in fact, I haven't really bumped into that. You have that on the BeagleBone. There's the CAPE addressing, but I haven't really bumped into that, need to do that for the Pi. So, it really would act like a standalone Pi plus the GPIO. So that's one board. The second board is a radio host adapter. And this board is very simple. All it is a place where you can mechanically mount one or two little handy talkies. You know, I hate to say it, but Bofangs. So like, let's say one of those 888s, the little $12 handy talkie, or the UV82. Mm-hmm. So if you wanted to build a simple node, you can take, like a simplex node, you can take one handy talkie, mount it to this circuit board. This board then sits on top of the board with the Raspberry Pi. And there's a set of headers, a header connectors that connect between the boards. And what you can do is on the Raspberry Pi board, it's got a power supply, a switching supply built in. So you can plug 12 volts into the Raspberry Pi board. That switching supply will take it down to the right 5 volts to power the Raspberry Pi, and it'll take the voltage and ship it up to the board where the Bofang radio is. And there's solder pads on the radio host adapter board that allow you to pull wires out of the Bofang to hook up audio in, audio out, COS, and PTT. And those signals can then be routed through the header down to the Raspberry Pi board. So with these two boards, you can make a voice over IP node like an all-star node.
So just out of curiosity, because you know I care deeply about this powering pies topic, how much current do you make available for the pie?
The power supply could put out well over an amp, probably 2 amps.
I don't know if in the project this thing will be run that hard.
No, it should handle it easily. I mean, like for example, I've got a beagle bone, and this thing draws maybe between 200 to 300 mils, depending on what it's doing. I think the Raspberry Pi is probably in the same ballpark. I don't think it's much more than that. I'd be surprised. Well, anyway, we'll figure it out. But there's plenty of headroom in the power supply. In fact, the biggest current hog would be the radios, because they're gonna pull half an amp to, depending on how much power you're putting out, if you're using the PAs or not. But anyway, conceptually, so you get the picture. You've got two boards sandwiched one on top of the other. The top board has one or two radios mounted to it, and the board below it has a Raspberry Pi and all the power supply and interface electronics to hook those two things together. So that's two boards. The third board is a two-port repeater controller. So this guy could be used standalone by itself without anything else, and have two sets of connectors so you can hook up to, let's say, a repeater or a repeater and a link radio or two repeaters or whatever. And it's got the tone decoder and the audio mixing and muting and all that stuff that you need in a basic, simple repeater controller. Now, that's also in the same form factor with the same pass-through headers that are on the other two boards. And now what you could do is you can now mix and match these boards. So, for instance, I could take that repeater controller and hook it up to a big radio, a big repeater. That's okay. Or I could say, well, I want to build a little baby repeater that I'm going to take with me in an ammo can. And so I'm going to get a pair of Bofang radios. I can't believe I'm saying this. But anyway, a pair of Bofang radios and maybe a little mobile duplexer. And that radio host adapter could sit right on top of the repeater controller board, and now you have a baby repeater. Now, I wouldn't suggest it for a high RF environment because those are lousy receivers, but for, you know, the campground portable repeater, it'd be okay. Now, let's say you want to take the third board with the Raspberry Pi, put that in the stack, and you could use that Raspberry Pi on the second port of the two-port repeater controller. So I can have one port that's a repeater, the second port that's my voice over IP link into the internet. So the whole point of this is that by having boards with the same form factor and a common set of interconnection pins, you can use them in various combinations to build anything from a simple repeater to a voice over IP node or a voice over IP linked repeater, or, you know, whatever you can dream up for this stuff. So that's the basic idea. And in fact, the relay board happens to be the same form factor. You could even stick a relay, I don't know why you do this, but you can even stick a relay board on top. And, you know, maybe you have a remote base and you're going to switch between a vertical and a horizontally polarized 2-meter antenna. Well, you can do that switching with the relay board and have that on port 2 of the repeater controller.
I mean, this sounds really ambitious.
It is, kind of. But, you know, it is ambitious, but I've been thinking about this for a really long time. And, you know, and I've done a lot of repeater controller design in the past, so I didn't have to invent everything from scratch. I could take kind of a known working little subcircuits and put them together in a fairly simple fashion. To make it all work. The fifth board that's not been done yet, but will come eventually, is a physical interface, sort of a general purpose IO board, where you can do a lot more flipping of relays and reading voltages and stuff like that. The repeater controller, as it sits, does give you a little bit of general purpose IO. There's a couple of voltmeter inputs and a couple of spare relay controls and stuff like that. But to really expand it in a big way, it'd be nice to have another board that does that. Now, with that fifth board, by the way, now you get more permutations. You could say, well, I want an internet-enabled switch. I want to take my Raspberry Pi, put it on the internet, and have that talk to my GPIO board that has a bunch of voltmeters and digital inputs and digital outputs or relay controls, temperature probes and such. So again, the whole spirit of this project is to have a collection of compatible boards that you can stack in various combinations to customize your project.
Well, I mean, and so take the All-Star and the Baofengs out for a second. I mean, what you're effectively getting or making available is to folks like my club are going to be able to have access to legendary Sierra radio systems, repeater controller quality and technology, but in a unit that is designed basically for a standalone repeater.
Kind of, yeah. So we're not reusing any of the code from the big SRS controller because it's much more complicated and sophisticated, and we really don't need all that. So we're really taking a very bare bones approach to the repeater controller functionality, but it should be adequate for what most people need.
I mean, and it sounds like you will have an option that, again, you can have a Pi on board, you can interface with other stuff, and just like way back when we did the remote repeater site monitoring episode, you're going to have those capabilities in this smaller configuration.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you can kind of start with one thing and get that working. And so, for instance, you might say, well, okay, I'm going to start with a repeater controller board and a pair of Baofeng radios as a benchtop RF testbed, which you would never put on a mountaintop in a million years. But for the workbench, it's fine. Once you kind of get that working, then you can say, well, I want to add voice over IP. Once you get that working, you can say, well, I'm going to rip the Baofeng host adapter off and interface this to a real Motorola repeater that's up on the repeater site. So, you know, you can kind of morph it over time as your needs change.
You know what is also coming to mind based on something we've talked about previously?
What's that?
Actually, let me clarify something. So you have the two Baofeng radios. The audio interfacing as far as what's coming in on radio A and going out radio B, is that wiring may be the wrong word, but is that, that's basically an audio path, I'm assuming, like from the headphone out jack to the microphone in jack or microphone in port.
Kinda. So you want to pick points in the radios that are as close to the radio end and not the user end as possible. So let me be specific. So for example, when you pull receive, this is true not just for this project, but universally, if you're going to build a repeater, when you pick your receiver audio, the last place you want to pick it from is the speaker, because that's the end of all of the audio processing. So speaker audio is really not a good place to get it. You want to go up the chain, up into the receiver, and pluck the audio right off the discriminator of the FM receiver. So in the FM receiver, from the antenna jack, you go through several stages of down conversion and filtering. And the last stage is when the FM signal is resolved into a baseband or a voltage that is essentially the modulated signal. After that, you start to go into all of the audio processing to eventually get to the speaker. So you go through, you know, preamps and an amplifier and a limiter and a squelch circuit and a bunch of stuff. So you want to pick it at that point. And that point, conveniently, is usually the high side of the volume pot, because it's that low level audio voltage off the discriminator that goes through an audio pot that then goes into the audio amplification stages. So that's the point where you pick off the receive audio. That's the discriminator audio. Similarly, on the transmit side, you don't want to shove audio into the microphone. And the reason you don't want to do that is because all the microphone amplification and filtering and limiting circuitry will alter the shape and the frequency response of your transmitted audio. So the purest point to insert the transmit audio is into the modulator. And so you've got to find the right spot to do that. And so on the Baofeng radios, the receive audio pick point I found is on the volume pot. And the transmit audio insertion point, I I don't think it's after the mic amplifier somewhere. I don't remember where it is in the circuit, but this is well documented on the web. You can just search it and find it. So anyway, so long way around the barn to say you kind of want to avoid the microphone and speaker amplifier stages and go before there.
Well, I mean, and that makes sense. For things like, you know, because it's the repeater controller that would give you, say, your CW ID and your tone decoding and encoding, right?
Yeah, yeah. So, essentially, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, so like, you know, like you keep calling this the Baofeng interface board, like that would actually interface with the appropriate stuff in the repeater controller so that signals are running through there and having stuff added to or decoded, et cetera.
Yeah, so the radio, the host adapter board is mostly a mechanical mount. It's a place where you can screw the radio. I put little holes in the circuit board that line up to the belt clip.
That's hilarious.
for the handy talk.
That is absolutely hilarious.
Yeah, and actually it looks pretty sweet. I've got one here in front of me. I'm waving it at the microphone. I'll take a picture of it and put it on the Facebook page. But I've got two UV82s mounted to the circuit board. And the only thing that's on the circuit board is, besides the radios screwed to it, are wires that come out of the radio. So you had to go into the radio and so slightly disassemble the radio and go in and attach five wires inside the radio and pull them out. And so that's power and ground, audio in and out, the carrier operated switch or COS carrier present signal out, and push to talk in. Those are the six wires. So those all come out, and then there's solder pads where those are soldered to on the host adapter board. Those signals are then routed to the header that then goes down to the board below it, which would be, let's say, the repeater controller. So all the active signal processing is happening in the repeater controller board. So basically the path of that, let's say the audio, for instance, the audio now goes in the repeater controller board, which in the case of the Baofengs came through that header. If you are hooking up to like a Motorola repeater, then there's another connector that's more convenient. You can screw terminal hookup wires to the radio. Anyway, so on the repeater controller board, there's a whole section which is the audio processing section. So that takes the discriminator audio in. And there's an amplification stage, then there's a level set pot, then there's another amplifier, and then at that point you have an audio bus which feeds into a switch, a CMOS logic controllable switch that lets you route the audio either to transmitter one or transmitter two. The output of that switch goes into a little mixer, which takes in the audio from either of the radios and the tone bus. And then that goes through another level, a gain stage, where you can set the transmit level, and then through an amplifier, and then back to the transmitter. So that's the chain that's duplicated, once for radio one and once for radio two, because it's a two-port controller. So anyway, you have these two parallel audio paths, so discriminator in to modulator out for each of the radios. And in the middle, you have a mixer and switches that let you route the signals from either receiver to either transmitter, plus mix in the telemetry audio from the CPU. So your CWID and stuff like that. So that's the audio section. The digital logic part is basically a processor that controls those switches. There's also a subcircuit, which is a DTMF tone decoder. So the audio from the two receivers feed the tone decoder, and then the output of the tone decoder goes into the PIC. So you can detect if a DTMF signal is decoded or not. And then, you know, if it's a legit command, then it executes the command and does something.
Oh, wow. And then I'm assuming that also does masking and all that.
What do you mean masking?
Well, you said like your other repeater controllers, like it won't repeat the DTMF.
Oh yes. Yeah. Yeah. So it'll mute. So the reason why, you have these switches, these electronic CMOS switches, in every audio path is to either route the audio or to mute the audio that you may not want. So if, for example, I go into the input and I hit a DTMF button, that DTMF digit needs to constantly go to the DTMF decoder, but I want to mute the audio going to the transmitter so you don't hear the tones coming out the transmitter.
Okay. You know, something else that just occurred to me, I don't remember what the model number was, but we had a conversation in a previous episode about they are these little, you know, maybe the size of two postage stamps side by side, 1 watt, you know, 2 meter and or VHF and UHF radio modules mm-hmm. that are, you know, they're supposed to basically be walkie-talkie system on a chip.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, I mean, there may be an opportunity to build a support board for those and you don't have to clip Baofengs because those radio yes. modules are about $6 to $8 a piece, maybe $5 to $8 a piece.
Yeah. And actually that was part of the thinking in the architecture, which is this sort of modularity. So let's say you wanted to do a board with those two radios on it. You need some additional digital control. A processor, a PIC or something that will interface to those boards to tell it what's the frequency and all that stuff. So that's a fairly involved project by itself. But the nice thing about this kind of an architecture is you can say, well, I'm going to get my repeater working with the Baofeng radios, and then I'm going to go design my own special radio board with those modules. And I'm going to unplug the Baofeng board and plug in this new board with my little radios. And now I have a new thing, and I could debug it and get it to work. So this sort of modularity was key to the project idea. But yeah, absolutely, those little radios would be perfect for a project like that.
You know, one of the things that I wonder is, I mean, I know the module is basically a radio. You use a microcontroller to control its tuning and, you know, frequency, blah blah blah. I wonder what other, if any other support electronics besides the control stuff are required. Like, I wonder if they require additional filtering or if that stuff's built in.
Yeah, we'd have to take a look. My guess is there's probably sufficient filtering that it would work in a reasonably low RF environment. But if you were going to take that up to a mountaintop with a lot of RF, then it's probably not going to work very well. So probably have a fair bit of overload or, you know, you might get other. I mean, one of the biggest problems at a repeater site is not only your receiver becoming desensitized or overloaded, but having other stray RF coming down the coax into your transmitter and mixing in your transmitter and producing spurs and re-radiating. And, you know, nothing you did, except you're just a vessel for all this mixing and trash to be generated. So, you know, you need a fair bit of filtering for self-protection and to make sure that your things aren't generating spurs where they shouldn't be. So, you know, even a very high quality receiver and transmitter often needs external devices like circulators to prevent that kind of a problem from happening. So the answer to your question is it depends. It really depends on the environment where you're going to put it. You know, if you're putting it in your garage, it's probably fine. If you're putting it on top of Mount Wilson in Los Angeles with every possible RF generator known to man, probably not a hot idea.
No, but I mean, but for that, like you said, with the repeater control board and the Pi interface board and the GPIO board, I mean, that's where you would get into hooking it up to a real radio.
Yes, exactly.
I think this sounds really interesting. Like I said, I know you've been working on it. You've sent me some pictures. It sounds fantastically ambitious. And I don't know, because the funny thing is for me, okay, in my dream world where both my kids grew up to be fantastically engaged hams, the idea of being able to throw up a low power repeater in my attic for the neighborhood, a 1 or 2 watt repeater would be fine for covering my mm-hmm. neighborhood, especially if I were to hook it up to a decent gain antenna. And of course, like even talking about using, I think they call them mobile duplexers, mm-hmm. like for 440, like that would be an option, or just have it be split band.
Yeah, really, you'd really want a mobile duplexer. You really don't. Well, you could split band.
Well, I mean, with the Baofengs, like that's what I would expect you're doing is, you know, having a split band repeater.
Well, so you have all the options. So you could do a simplex node if it was just being not a repeater, but just a VOIP node. If it's being a repeater, you could do split band, or you could do same band with a mobile duplexer. Some people, like if you listen to the episode John did on field radio a couple episodes ago, he had a fella on that was doing a field deployable UHF Parahandy talkies in a can, and he just mounted the antennas vertically, and it worked. But that's a case where the range was very limited. He didn't need a lot of range, and so it worked okay. But that's really not a recipe for success in a lot of places.
Well, and I thought the quote unquote sane Sonic repeater controller he used, I thought it was a store and forward module. In which case,
yeah. I mean, that's a whole other animal.
Yeah, because for those of you who aren't familiar, you can buy even Argent Data Systems makes a store and forward, but it's basically a little box that records the audio, and then when the recording is done, then it retransmits. So it's not a full duplex. Repeater operation, there's a little bit of delay built in, but it still accomplishes roughly the same goal.
Yeah, but I got a vent here. That is a technique of last resort in my mind, because if you can hear the originating station and you hear the repeater, once you hear the same message repeated twice a couple of times, you're done. I mean, it's just so irritating.
Well, you say that, but in theory, the repeater is going to have an input and your radio is going to be tied to the output. So you would not hear in the natural course of things, even if you were standing, 100 feet away.
But most people use them as simplex repeaters. They'll put them on a simplex channel, like on a FRS radio, for instance.
Oh, yeah.
But
listening to that episode, and maybe I misunderstood, I was under the impression that two radios, two separate frequencies. I'll have to put a link.
I don't know if it was at the end of the day, I don't know if that application he did was a store and repeat. Kind of simplex or whatever, half duplex repeater or a real repeater. I thought it was operating as a real, real time crossband repeater, but we'll have to go back and talk to John and find out.
Yes.
Anyway, those are all options. And, if you're, a lot of guys want to tinker around with building a repeater, and this is kind of a nice way where you could get into that and learn how it works and, build your own stuff and fiddle around with it, and maybe even use it for something on a hill.
Well, cool. Yeah, and like I said, I'm this idea of creating the little radio module boards with the little crenellated, DR800 or something boards. I'll try to DRA808M, and that's looks like the UHF version.
Actually, I was just looking it up here. I see one that's UHF ham band. Amateur radio walkie-talkie module, DRA818U,
yes.
For $12.
Yeah. I mean, I'm just looking at Tindy, which I searched for walkie-talkie on Tindy. And you know what I just came across is there is a standalone DMR module for $40. But the future is amazing.
So these little modules, by the way, if you were just making a, repeater to cover the house and maybe the block, this would be perfectly fine and a great experiment, and you'd probably have no overload problems. If it were going into any kind of, it's essentially the same performance as an inexpensive handy talkie. So, you would never put an inexpensive handy talkie as your repeater receiver on a RF intensive site. But for a guy building a thing in his garage, this is fine. And super small. I mean, actually, this might be a really cool project to take a couple of these modules and make it just an integrated, a pick with a very minimal amount of audio processing between two of these modules, and say, well, there's your baby repeater controller with radios, or your baby repeater, really. Just add mobile duplexer and you're done.
Yeah, I mean, I'm still would aim for the crossband, just because it's simpler, it's cheaper, and pretty much every radio made in the last 20 years can handle crossband repeater entries.
Yeah, that's now you're still going to run two different antennas,
unless you have a diplexer, right?
Yeah, right. What I don't know is if there's enough leakage through the diplexer to wipe out one of these receivers. That would be a good experiment.
And by out, you mean cook?
I mean, just to overload it, even if it doesn't damage it, just, would it just swamp it?
Well, I don't know, man. Those $12 Baofengs are known for their incredibly solid front ends.
Yes. While driving nails.
Yeah. Actually, that second part might be true.
That might be true.
Yeah, not for like the UV5Rs, but like those, the ones that are more like the dumbed down commercial versions.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, to kind of wrap on that whole board stack thing. So where that's at is I have, let's see, the host adapter for the radio is, I have that done. It's sitting right here. I have the first version of the repeater controller board built up, and I found enough errors in the design that I, just stupid mistakes, that I, rather than cut and jump it, I just made another version of the board. So I'm waiting for that to come back. And I'm also waiting for the Raspberry Pi host adapter to come back. So if there's no major gaffes in the design, all the base hardware will be here and probably prototypes built by Christmas. And then the software, there's really two software projects. The All-Star Node software project is just implementing what's available off the shelf. There's no development to be done. It's just making sure I didn't make any mistakes in the wiring, and that should be good to go. So the big software effort is really the firmware for the controller, and the base code is done, but there's still a ways to go. So my guess is the actual repeater controller code probably won't be really ready for anybody to play with until, like, I don't know, March-ish, with all the other projects going on. So
let me help you out. Our goal would be to introduce that sometime around or at Dayton.
Perfect.
Yes.
Yeah, let's do that.
Maybe I missed this subtlety, because I this entire project started for two reasons. Number one, I started bugging you, hey, Mr. You know, super complicated repeater controller builder, my club could use a really simple repeater controller. So that's where one component I kind of, you know, nudged you on.
Yes.
And you know, then the other one was the, after the conversation with the digital roundtable, you all of a sudden, and I know Eric Guth from the QSO Today podcast had, you know, really been putting the All-Star thing in your ear. But that, I mean, it started off as in like, oh, let's just build the VoIP bridge for it. And so all I was expecting was a little hat that went on a Raspberry Pi that ran the Asterisk server, and that you were using, you know, it was basically a hotspot. And of course, you've taken that to the nth degree. But is that hotspot, that core hotspot functionality, still available?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, all you need is the Raspberry Pi board, and then hook that up to a radio. And if you want to make it easy, just take this HT host adapter board, slap it on top, and hook up a single Bofang, and there's your hotspot. So the two board set, the Raspberry Pi board and the radio host adapter, essentially cleans up the mess. So if you look at the examples, what they'll show is a couple of things and a mess of cables. So here's my Raspberry Pi, and then there's a sound card dongle, and there's some wires off the sound card dongle that go to an interface box, and that interface box connects to the radio, and you know, and then there's a DC to DC power adapter to go from 12 volts to the handy talkies voltage, and on and on. And so you have this pile of junk in a heap on the desk. And what I've done essentially is taken the equivalent of all of those pieces and reformulated into two circuit boards so that it's identical in function. So the All-Star software should just work. But it takes out all the cabling and power supplies and all that jazz and reduces it down into these two circuit boards.
I'm stuck because the hamvoip.org is the running the All-Star asterisk server on BeagleBone Black or Raspberry Pi. I know we linked to it in a previous show. It's Micronode, I think.
No. You're on the right track. Yeah. So here it is. I just pulled it up here. So hamvoip.org, and the title is asterisk All-Star on the BeagleBone Black and the Raspberry Pi 2.3. And what you see there at the top of the page are a Pi and a BeagleBone and some interface boards and a power adapter. And I think it's probably missing it, you know, a cable to the radio. So by the time you add the radio and everything else, then you have this big pile of stuff. So what you see essentially described on these web pages, hamvoip.org, that re-implemented into two circuit boards. So it's a nice rigid kind of screwed together unit.
Okay.
Is what we're shooting for here. So their idea is really brilliant. I mean, I like their I like their approach. I think the work these guys have done to port the All-Star software, which is essentially the Asterisk PBX software plus a bunch of ham stuff, porting that to the Raspberry Pi and then making all that work with standard off-the-shelf $3 sound card fobs is essentially what I've pulled together into this board set.
Well, cool.
Yeah.
The other thing I guess I would ask is the intention that these are going to be completed boards and not DIY boards?
Oh, excuse me. Good question. Not sure. We need to figure that out still. I mean, the radio host adapter depends on your radio. So that's a DIY board. The other boards are all through-hole components by design in order to allow people to assemble it themselves. So we'll see. My experience with having people assemble complex repeater controllers in the past was fairly dismal, I have to say. I had some really sharp people who were masters at installing chips backwards and not installing capacitors and wondering why the audio didn't work. So I'm kind of tempted to avoid that by just having them fully assembled. But I think a lot of the whole purpose for doing this was not to make a product. It was to make a thing that people could then use to make their own projects out of it. So I would prefer to make this just raw boards or kits.
Okay.
So, you know, we'll see. I mean, by Dayton, the new target date, we'll have that all sorted out.
Well, man.
Yeah.
And I thought I talked a long time about my workbench.
Yeah. Do we have any listeners left? Do you think anybody's still listening to this?
It hasn't been 3 hours yet.
Oh, yeah. Well, we got a ways to go.
Well, we're only halfway through the show.
Yeah. Well, on that note, why don't we take a quick break and come back? This episode of The Workbench is brought to you by Autodesk Eagle PCB Design Tools. All of our projects we're doing on The Workbench use Eagle. It's great for schematic capture and board layout. You can easily generate all of the output files necessary to manufacture a circuit board. And whether you're building one board or 100 boards for your friends, use Eagle Tools because they have really excellent support. They've got a great library of available components. It's widely used amongst the maker and the professional board design tool. You'll enjoy using the tools, and there's a lot of great new features. Check it out at autodesk.com/eagle, and you could download a free copy of the PCB design tool today and get started doing your project.
So as you can see, we have a lot of exciting things planned for 2018, and we are going to do our absolute best to try to get these things into your hands. There will be additional information about a new e-commerce presence as well, where folks are going to be able to order these things. But again, that's further off into the future, so stay tuned for that. On the other side of the show, of course, at the end of the day, what we produce first and foremost is an actual podcast. You know, so the projects are fantastic, a great way to engage and a great way to learn. But George, I mean, what are some of the things that we are in the process of lining up for 2018 topics?
Oh, wow. We have some really great topics coming up. One of the more exciting ones in my mind is we're going to do a special on AMSAT Phase 4B, which is a project that I think a lot of listeners may not be familiar with. And it's a next generation geostationary or geosynchronous satellite that will allow you to have 24/7 satellite communications using 5 and 10 gigahertz. And so that system is being designed now, and we have a guest speaker that will share information about that very soon. So we're excited about that. We've got our Baycon conference coming up with about 8 great presentations that we're going to try to record and make available on the show. We're going to talk about test equipment with the folks from Digilint. We talked about the Analog Discovery multi-instrument USB device on the shopping show. So we're going to get those folks on here and talk about that. Wow, we just have lots of things lined up. We'll probably hear a lot more from Elecraft this year. We had a great kickoff with David talking about HF amplifiers, and we'll do more of that with them. We're going to be looking at design tools, electronic computer-aided design, and mechanical design tools, so more PCB and 3D design tools.
Yeah, and on top of that, I've been having conversations with Yusuf of AirSpy. We would like to get him to come on and walk us through a little bit more in depth on direct sampling software-defined receivers. What are the considerations of design? How do they work? And then, ultimately, how do you handle things in the software side? On top of that, along the continuing to design circuits with Eagle or walking through some of the MCAD stuff, we would actually like to try to figure out a way to continue to do some more, I'll call it pre-recorded live stream type content. So in addition to the audio podcast, having a few specials here and there, like we did when George and the gang walked me through designing my first circuit board in Eagle. I still owe George a tutorial and walking him through designing his first enclosure with Fusion 360. And so we're going to look at trying to do some more of that that live stream type content. Invite folks along to hang out when we broadcast it on YouTube. And then, of course, make the recorded content available after the fact. Yeah, and we're also will plan on doing another series of listener projects episodes this year. That was one of my favorite things that we did last year is the couple of episodes on getting folks who listen to the show to volunteer their time to come on and talk about what they have on their workbenches.
So what would you like to hear on the show sometime in 2018 that we don't have set up yet?
Honestly, there's two topics that are, one is just hyper interesting to me. The other one is one that I cannot believe we have not done anywhere in the family of Ham Radio 360 podcast. We have not done a ton of exploration on, yet it is so fundamental to this hobby that most people will tell you it is the most important thing in your station.
The 3D printer?
No, antennas.
Well, of course.
I mean, there were a couple episodes. Dr. Ed Fong spent time with us to talk about near vertical incident skywave and to talk to us about his very famous twin lead J-pole antenna. But we haven't really spent a lot of time deep diving in that area. I mean, I think learning about how mag loops work, talking about trade-offs in designing traditional wire antennas. I think there's a lot of content there that we would love to find an expert to bring forward to the audience. The other thing that is really interesting to me, and of course, this has been highlighted by the recent explosion in FT8 activity on the bands, but just weak signal communication in general, I think is really interesting because you talk about shifting of concerns, with error correction and using long time bases. I think I've heard somebody say that some of these modes actually can operate with a negative signal to noise ratio, which blows my mind.
Well, just from a casual listener point of view, you listen on the band, you can hardly hear something, but you can see it on the computer screen way down in the noise and be able to pluck it out. It really is amazing. In fact, I was listening to Eric Guth's amazing podcast series, and every time he interviews somebody, he asks them, what's the most exciting thing in ham radio today? And I think in the last, 10 or 20 interviews, almost everybody said digital. So all these like really accomplished, famous hams from all kinds of walks of life in different parts of the world, a lot of them are focusing on digital as being like a huge thing. So of course it is. But I think getting a better understanding of some of that stuff and the great work that Joe Taylor's done to really spearhead so much of that HF weak signal stuff is just really exciting.
So what about you? What are some things that if we are given the opportunity you would like to explore this year?
Wow, there's just so many. I think the thing that I have not really dug into is satellite work. And I mentioned the AMSAT Phase 4B. I've not really dug into satellites because, there's just so many other things to do and I just haven't gotten to it. But the things that they're talking about with these satellites that will be positioned over North America 24/7 to allow you to communicate anytime, day or night, presents a phenomenal opportunity for regional communications and emergency communications. And the technology to really do that is it's all going to be digital based up in the microwave bands. And so I'm just really excited to take a look at that. A lot of my friends have either done satellites or are very active in millimeter wave contesting, like microwave contests and such. So maybe my step into that world is going to be around the phase 4B stuff when it comes out. So I want to learn more about that.
Well, the other thing that I would definitely would like to do is remind our listeners, if you have any ideas, topics you would like us to pursue, topics you would like to come talk about, please do not hesitate to reach out by on Twitter. You can reach me at KF7IJZ. You can reach George at KJ6VU, or you can send an email to workbench@hamradioworkbench.com. But in the meantime, again, we want to thank everybody for making 2017 another fantastic year. We are very much looking forward to continuing the Ham Radio Workbench and continuing on in the Ham Radio 360 family of shows. Excited about what John Jacobs is doing with the Field Radio Podcast. Again, if you have not listened to that yet, check it out by searching for Field Radio Podcast in your podcast app of choice. In the meantime, one final reminder in this episode that starting in February, the Ham Radio Workbench will no longer be available on the Ham Radio 360 feed. So please go to your app or, feed or player of choice, search for Ham Radio Workbench to make sure that you continue receiving the great content that you have come to enjoy from us.
So that's it for this show. Thank you guys so very much for listening and all the email and all the feedback. And we look forward to more in 2018.
Absolutely. So we want to take the opportunity to wish everybody a happy and safe holidays. May Santa bring you everything that you want for your shack and your workbench. Have a fantastic New Year's, and we will see you in 2018.
See you in 2018. 73s.
73. Wrong button.
You didn't press the re-record over what we already recorded, did you?
Oh, wait. I thought you were recording this.
Before we start today's show, we have a very important announcement.
I'm getting talked over by my co-host. All right. I didn't mark it. Don't go until I tell you to go.
Is this thing on?
Yes. That's why I'm telling you to stop talking.
I have a box of peppermint chocolate bark in front of me.
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, it is. I'll hold up to the microphone. You can sniff it. There's some wheat in that chaff.